Mini-episode 803 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late-night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode number 803. I'm FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris, here today with five of our top ensemble moments to mark our 10-year anniversary celebration. This program started as a pure ensemble on January 14th, 2007, dedicated to bringing back the Great American Radio Show as a program where nothing was off topic. We began with the original dignitaries of the FDH Lounge, and as logistics went on to make assembling all of them together for every show impossible, we expanded the roster of dignitaries, even as the originals have remained a strong part over the years. We've never gathered up top ensemble moments to this point, even as we've put together several compilations of the show featuring our strong guest roster, because candidly, that's what sells in marketing. But it's been the byplay within our group of dignitaries that's been the heart and soul of this program, not least of which because it's set the tone and template that we plug all of our guests into when they visit. Every one of the dignitaries has played a significant part in building this one-of-a-kind program, and while they're not all featured here, they are all appreciated for their contributions to our unique show. This mini-episode is going to take us in many ways back to our roots at theoldsportstalknetwork.com, where we aired 152 full-length episodes before moving into our present format. Frequently, we would have wildly disparate segments airing back-to-back because of the variety of our show, and so it is today. Our first clip aired exactly 10 years ago today, on Episode 1, January 14, 2007, featuring a discussion about whether specialists are worthy candidates for the Hall of Fame in different sports. Just 2 weeks later, on Episode 2, January 28, 2007, we had one of my all-time favorite segments, Be True to Your School, and that is our second clip. With many of us on the panel that night having gone to Ohio University, there was quite the raucous and hilarious debate about who to root for in our alma mater's football game with Ohio State the following year. On our 100th episode, on April 28th, 2010, we had a very spirited edition of our Pigskin Think Tank talking about many aspects of football strategy. Up next, on April 12th, 2011, on episode 143, we cycled through our list of the top 50 pro wrestlers of all time and debated their various merits. Last but not least, in June of 2012, on mini-episode number 132, in one of our Pantheon segments that revealed the results of group voting for the best of the best in various categories, we filtered through the candidates for best underpublicized vacation spot. The sole common denominator here, with five different segments spanning well over a dozen contributors in all, great conversation. We truly hope you enjoy it. My topic for the next segment here that I'm going to throw out there, and again, I will be pleasantly surprised if too many people agree with me on this, but my sense is that we should have people in the Hall of Fames in various sports there. And in football, there are a couple of examples that come to mind. Steve Tasker, somebody that spent an entire career excelling on special teams. Normally, I would say you can't have that narrow of a focus, but if you're talking about somebody that dominant, over that strong of a period of time, somebody genuinely considered to have been such an integral part of four AFC championship teams, I think he would be the exception to the rule. I would also say Bud Carson in football. For what he did with the Steel Curtain in the 70s, again, a lot of the acclaim goes, as it should, a lot of it should go to Chuck Knoll, but I think that Bud Carson, what he did as a coordinator, takes it to that level in there. And I really think that we can come up with examples, I suppose, in other sports, but in terms of a very narrow band of specialists, and maybe other people will have other examples of that, just in terms of that, those two people exemplify what I'm thinking about here in terms of somebody that belongs in. I guess for baseball, now that I think about it, Leo Mazzoni, again, what he did in Baltimore this past year, maybe got to count against him a little bit, but what he did in Atlanta all of those years as a pitching coach. And it's unheard of to make the Hall of Fame as a pitching coach, a defensive coordinator in football, a special teams specialist in football. It doesn't happen. But Tim, let's start off with you here. Your thoughts on this. I'm not anticipating a lot of sympathy here from the folks tonight, so you tell me what you think.
Well, I mean, if you have, I'm on your side here. I mean,
okay.
I think, you know, if there's enough of a, you know, I'm not sure the examples that you've given
okay. That
I would agree with. Another guy that I think of, although I'm not a Phil Jackson fan, might be Tex Winter.
That's a very good example. That's like exactly what I'm thinking.
You know,
about.
I mean, I wouldn't be on board with that. So although the examples, you know, the Bud Carsons, the Steve Taskers, the Leo Mazzonis, I'm not sure that I would vote for those examples, but if someone else, if we can give another example or someone else were to emerge, you know, in that kind of category, I wouldn't be opposed to it. I mean, if they revolutionize the something in the game, I mean, the Hall of Fame, I mean, this is a completely different topic altogether, but, you know, I've heard a lot of people say in recent years, you know, we've turned the Hall of Fames into the halls of very good. And that's not what they are. I mean, they're halls of fame, and it's kind of been watered down.
And I agree with that. I'm kind of a proponent of, in all of these sports, really, maybe building like a separate wing and maybe having like a separate type of, okay, good enough for the Hall of Fame. But I agree with you. I mean, if you got like Rabbit Moranville in baseball, which is the one that really chaps my ass, just because enough old-timers like playing with him, what do you have, like a .258 batting average lifetime? It's just a friggin' joke.
And he's got a cool name.
Exactly. I got to give it to him for the name, but
but
crap, you got to be able to do better than that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's part of it's reflective of the inclusive society that we live in.
It is.
You know, partially.
It is.
But definitely. And, you know, this again, I don't know if I'm getting off topic, but, I mean, the separate wing, no. That's what all-star teams are for. That's what all-decade teams are for. Hall of Fame are the very best of the very best, and the shouldn't be separate wings. They should be. That's what it is to get
in
the Hall of Fame.
Can't put the toothpaste back in the Hall of Fame tube, though. They're already there. Now, don't get
exactly,
me wrong.
Right,
I would
right.
gladly evict Rabbit Moranville's bust out onto the lawn myself. I would gladly carry it out if I
right.
wouldn't be arrested.
They're plaques in baseball, though.
They're plaques. You're right. Yeah, exactly. I'm getting so far ahead of myself here. Yes, the plaques that they have there, the busts in football. Trust me, I would be up for doing the house cleaning myself. I'd donate a weekend to go there and just clear out all the rubbish. So I'm with you. I'm in sympathy, but it's not going to happen. And again, there's a lot of different ways. I would imagine subsequent times here, we may talk about other aspects of the Hall of Fame. Certainly the steroid stuff's been on everybody's tongue now, but I wanted to go kind of like a little different way just to kind of symbolize what this show's about. What type of people should be in there, Chris?
Rick, I want to agree with you. I agree with you on this point.
Really?
I agree with you about the both of you regarding halls of fame being watered down in recent years. They really have been.
Okay.
But I also agree with you about position coaches and specialists. The whole point of the Hall of Fame is you are, you know, years of excellence at the game. You know, whether you're a coach, you know, head coaches get in, owners have gotten in, different aspects of the game. You know, you were years of excellence at the game. So what does it matter if you are a punter, whether you are a defensive end, you're a cornerback, a quarterback, or you are the defensive coordinator? You're still doing your part of the game. That is, you know, the quarterback doesn't go in because, you know, as a defensive end, you know, he goes in because of quarterback. You know, if you're the defensive coordinator, then you should be eligible to go in as a defensive coordinator if you have created some excellent defenses through the years. And I agree with you about Bud Carson on that point. And you make a great point about Leo Mazzoni in the sense that even with the Baltimore situation, Joe Torre, unless he's the Yankee skipper, he's not going to the Hall of Fame. You know, his record before the Yankees and all their, you know, $200 million spent, his record was at 500. He
less
wasn't
than 500.
Less than 500.
Two stints, as man.
Exactly.
Yeah, his record was lousy. So why should he be in the Hall of Fame? Just because, you know, Steinbrenner spent a lot of money and he just happened to be the guy at the time? So I agree with you. You're 100% right on this topic.
Okay, surprising consensus so far. We have another one of our dignitaries, Nathan Noy, back on line one. Before we do, Jason, let's go across the glass. Your thoughts on this? Are you gonna break the surprising consensus so far, or what do you think? Do you think that you have to have one of the jobs, i.e., starting player on offense or defense in a sport, head coach or manager? Do you think that's necessarily a prerequisite to being in the Hall of Fame?
No, but before I get into that, I want to go back to this wing idea.
Yeah.
And not that I'm trying to rehash it or tear it down, but on the fan union program that we have running on Mondays.
Monday nights, 8 o'clock, right?
We brought this up, and not to differentiate between great and good, but maybe there should be the delinquent wing or the rated R wing or the one where if you're taking your 6-year-old son to Cooperstown for the first time, you want him to know about the great ones. And then there's some side stories you don't really feel he's ready for, like Pete Rose. And I'll just say this right now, I don't give a damn what you think is wrong. He's the greatest hitter there ever was, at least as far as singles are concerned, if not just pure hitting. So it really upsets me that he's not in the Hall of Fame. Maybe he goes in that wing. Maybe Bonds goes in that wing. But that's a whole different discussion.
That's not a bad idea. Pete Rose goes in there for the gambling. You can put guys in there for the steroids. I read a story the other day for the first time. I can't believe I never saw this one before. But I guess Ty Cobb stabbing a black man because he thought he was uppity. You could put him in that wing also.
Exactly.
I can't believe I never saw that one before. I saw that like, damn, Ty Cobb was hardcore. I can't believe I never heard that story before. Nathan's
going to just point out that specialists are gay.
Probably, yes. And Nate is also an expert on miscreants also, so you could take this any number of ways you wanted to, Nate.
Yeah, I'm sure Ty Cobb's in the KKK Hall of Fame, by the way.
Probably, so. Yeah. What a wonderful guy he was.
There's a clear career path for these guys, Rick. If you're so good at being a coach, a specialist, then you have a career path to become a head coach. I mean, on a coaching end, if you're not the guy with the L's and the W's behind his name, I don't believe there's any place for you in the Hall of Fame. I mean, those guys face the heat. Those guys are the ones with the record beside their name. If you're such a great special teams coach, such a great offensive or defensive coordinator, you're going to get a head coaching job at some point.
You know what?
But who's to say that you're going to receive the same level of excellence? Let's just assume for a second, for our local listeners, that Romeo Crennel gets fired after next year, and he goes and becomes a defensive coordinator under somebody else, somewhere else, and goes on for another 10 to 15 years and never allows more than 10 points a game. He was a great defensive coordinator, and he just couldn't handle being a head coach.
He shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame. He can't get the job done. I mean, if your team doesn't win games, then you're not that good, and you don't have a place in the Hall of Fame.
I'm going to disagree.
If he's such a great coordinator, he should be able to handle the whole team.
No,
call it defensive plays himself.
I'm going to disagree with you on that one. Couldn't get the job done. I mean, you're saying he couldn't get the head coaching job done, but as a coordinator, he may have been a great coordinator. So in the job that he did and the job that he was paid to do, he did a great job. Whether or not he's a head coach, some people aren't cut out to be the guy.
Well,
but they are cut out to be...
Well, the Hall of Fame is all about the guy. I mean, if you're a great middle manager with a top corporation, you're never going to get the million-dollar payday. Guess what?
Yeah, but
congratulations. You're a great middle manager. You're not the guy. You don't belong in the Hall of Fame. Yeah, Hall of Fame is about the guy.
Yeah, but Nathan, what if you are a great defensive end in a 3-4, and you play 10 years in a 3-4, and you just dominate the league, and you go to a 4-3, and you're not finding your way in that system, and you're not producing the way you did in the 3-4 system. That's sort of the same thing. You're sort of taking it away from them, saying, "Well, you should be able to handle the 4-3-2." So that means that you're not the defensive end that we thought you were.
Then you hold out and demand a trade if the system isn't fit well to your skill set. I mean, we've seen
again skill set. You can be a great defensive coordinator, but not be a great head coach. It's about skill set.
Well, and clearly this is good stuff we got here. I'm going to throw out another example here, Nathan, because I think I got something that contradicts you, and I'm going to see what the preeminent hoops guy here at STC, Jason Jones, has to say about this. My example would be Eddie Jordan. Is there any effing doubt whatsoever that this guy was working Byron Scott like a puppeteer with his hand up his tuchus the two times they won the Eastern Conference Championship here. Byron Scott on his own sucks ass, period. Eddie Jordan was the man controlling him at the time, making them look good. Is there any doubt? First of all, Jason, do you have any doubt about that part of it whatsoever? And does that kind of back up what I'm saying about assistants?
I agree with that in general. However, the downfall to basketball, football and baseball, I think a little bit, and maybe even hockey to some degree, you really do depend on the team, even if you have talent. For instance, the team that I thought had the most talent in all of football as of today lost, and that was the San Diego Chargers. They've got some beasts of talent on that team, but the Patriots, as much as it pains me to say, found a way to win. You get that with baseball, too. You look at our Indians. I'll defer the baseball discussion since you guys have probably forgotten more than I'll ever know. But my thought would be Hafner had a great season, you know, so on and so forth. But if the whole team doesn't play that well, no big deal. In basketball, though, he can ride Chris Paul and maybe another couple good players as far as you want to go. And a better analogy is LeBron James, in my humble opinion, is the greatest basketball player on the planet right now. They have the best record in the East, but do you really believe that the Cleveland team is that great? And the reason I'm bringing this up, I think that if Chris Paul combined with another couple good guys who have a good run here and there could give Byron Scott a championship or at least an appearance in a championship series, which is a travesty because he's a terrible coach.
Yeah, exactly. Not because of anything he's done. And unfortunately, and this has been such a great segment, it's a shame that just to keep this on a semblance of being on pace, we're going to have to get away from it. But I want to throw this out here as a final thought here, and we'll get a thought from Nathan Noy here before we go to break on this. This is courtesy of Paul Belfi. He IM'd this to us here. And you're talking about miscreants maybe having their own wing of the Hall of Fame here, Jason Jones's idea, which I kind of like. Certainly, who would be in there in football? Who would be any better of an example than the Fatty Arbuckle of our time, O.J. Simpson? And there are two things that Belfi sent. One, this is an article from EWAS.com, an AP story that says that he claims a chapter from his unpublished book that hypothesizes how he would have killed his ex-wife and her friend was mostly created from a ghostwriter's research and is not a confession. Quote, I'm saying it's a fictional creation. It has so many holes in it that anybody who would know anything about it would know that I didn't write it. End quote. So that's what he's claiming for one. Number two, and I tell you, I don't want to know how Belfi found this out. I don't even want to know. He sent me a link to an eBay page that has O.J. Simpson's book. Remember, all copies were supposed to be shredded. You can buy it on eBay. The starting price was $1,500 in this auction. The buy it now price is $2,500. So, and shipping costs are $30. And,
who would want that on their mantle?
Why would you want that?
Yeah, and you know what? You people can go find it yourselves. We're not going to post the link on STC, and the scumbag who's trying to make some blood money off of it can have you find it another way.
People to think about that,
yes.
When you head off to break. Since we're talking about Hall of Fame,
yes,
Marty Schottenheimer, he's now number 5, I believe it is, on all wins of all time as a head coach in the NFL. Should he be in the Hall of Fame?
Only if he goes in on a double date with Chuck Knox. That's basically what I'm saying. Let's induct both of them together. Nate, your closing thoughts for the segment?
Well, just real quick. I mean, you've got guys like Dennis Rodman. What do you think about him? Is he a Hall of Famer?
As a specialist? Hell yeah.
Absolutely.
Greatest rebounder or just about?
You know what? I don't care what sport it is. If you are universally regarded as the guy, the best to do one stat, you're going to have guys like Jerry West or Oscar Robertson for basketball, but you're also going to have Dennis Rodman. If Steve Nash goes down in history for his career averaging like 15 assists a game, 18 assists a game, which is unheard of, he should go in for that reason and that reason alone. So, yes, to Dennis Rodman.
Yeah. And again, as coaches and players, different argument. Dennis Rodman won 5 championships. I mean, these guys win championships. That's what puts them in the Hall of Fame. Ozzie Smith. Greatest defensive player of all time. I know, Rick, you don't actually think he belongs in the Hall of Fame, do you?
His offense was an offset. That's where, for a Steve Tasker, there was nothing to offset what he did. But for a Rabbit Moranville and Ozzie Smith, same guy, by the way, if you ask me, and even Omar Vizquel, I'll throw that in the mix here, too. Nope, sorry. You didn't produce enough offensively to augment the defense in any way. That's my, and if that sounds a little contradictory, so be it. But if there's anything that you do, I don't think it is contradictory, by the way. I'm not conceding that. I'm just saying some people may say that. But what I'm saying is, if there's anything that you could do to offset your brilliance in an area by being a detriment, I'm not in favor of you being in there. So
no, what you're saying is that offense is way more important than defense in baseball.
I think it is. Yeah, I mean, I really think it is. That, I mean, if you're a real slaptastic like an Omar or an Ozzie or a Rabbit Moranville, nope, sorry.
Well, I agree. Ozzie should be in. I don't think Omar should be in.
Ozzie has done the championships, guys.
Ozzie
revolutionized as many as Nathan Noy. I mean, didn't get it done.
He also had a year where I think he had no home runs. So yeah, you have to look at that.
That's
part
okay.
Of
the home runs is only one small facet of the game of baseball.
And with that said, we're setting the table now for what is going to be a very excellent discussion. Paul, again, it's not a popular point of view among those who wear the green and the white. I myself will be wearing the green and the white in the shoe next year, as I was in 1999. So lay it out for us and tell me why, in your estimation, it's okay to root against Ohio on that esteemed day.
Well, Red, first of all, I don't think that's necessarily an unpopular view amongst the green and white. Most of my friends that I graduated with, both in Scripps and in other schools of Ohio University in 2004 and 2005, almost exclusively shared my viewpoint of Ohio State first. Why? Because they were raised Ohio State fans. Oh. But more importantly,
I want their names so we can take their degrees.
Oh, that's very astute of you, Chris. At any rate, to say that it's an unpopular view amongst the green and white, I think is a bit of a misnomer, just because it's the unpopular view on Bobcat Attack, which is the hardcorest of the hardcores, the parochial, the numb in the brainular area, and most importantly, the deluded to the point of psychosis people on that message board should not be mistaken under any circumstances for regular Ohio University students who grew up in Ohio and had their own free will of choices in terms of growing up and watching a team, and happened to be the Ohio State Buckeyes. Basically, what's being asked of people like me, Rick, is that years, decades of memories and sports fandom be set aside for the choice of a school based on career and long-term goals in one's life.
Wow, well,
I'm not saying that I don't root for Ohio University. I certainly love Ohio University. I was crestfallen when we lost to those goddamn Florida Gators in the national championship, in the national tournament in 2005. I was pissed because we should have hit that three-pointer and won that game, damn it. But that isn't necessarily the point here. I didn't say I wanted Ohio State to go out and beat the hell out of OU in 2008 when they played. I said I wanted OU to keep it close and keep it respectable because I want them to have a showing that can still positively affect both contributions from alumni and recruiting on a national level. And certainly, if they were to hang tough with the beast up Route 33, obviously that's still going to affect the way that Solich is able to go out and recruit in the greater Ohio area.
Well, something you said, Paul, it's a little dispiriting if we're to take it at face value here. Chris, is this a generational thing? Are we the grizzled old guys that believe in school loyalty? All the kids are going for Ohio State now because it's the cool thing to do.
I
are we obsolete?
No, I don't think so. I think his perspective on this is distorted. When I go onto campus and, you see, I've been, recently in the last couple of years, I've been down to the campus. I've seen people with Ohio State gear on, students at Ohio University, and I ask them point blank, well, who are you going to root for when Ohio, and they tell me, oh, Ohio, of course, it's my school. And so I think most people, Rick, share your position on that, is that if they grew up an Ohio State fan for whatever reason, then they're still loyal in the end to their own university. I disagree with what's riding on a game like that. Sure, Ohio State maybe has an opportunity for a BCS bowl, but for a school like Ohio, it's a potential for a program defining win, some momentum that can be built for a program that's trying to sort of resurrect itself from the good years, which unfortunately were in the 1960s. And so there is a lot on the line for your alma mater in terms of that, and just keeping it close isn't good enough. So I think it's insane to think that you would actually root against your own school, your own alma mater, for a school that you don't have any actual direct connection to.
Well, in as much as my point of view is very closely mirrored by one Jim Cushla, and I want to bring him in because, again, I think Cush, and Chris agrees with me, has taken a lot of unfair stuff from the listeners. Wouldn't be the first time, won't be the last time, Mondays through Fridays, 9 a.m. to noon, but maybe it's the perspective of going to an out-of-state school and saying the same thing I'm saying is what grates on people. But, Jimmy, defend yourself here. I agree with you. Chris agrees with you. And, again, it's not at all shameful to root for Virginia Tech under those circumstances, although I won't be rooting for Virginia Tech if they ever play Ohio State, but nothing wrong if you do it.
Well, part of it is also that I have an interesting line as a fan. See, I, like the rest of you, also have the perspective of growing up around this team. I mean, I've heard of the Woody Hayes and the two Heisman trophies coming later in the 70s and everything, and the titles and everything. And it does. It has an absolutely rich history. I mean, my family is totally born, bred in Ohio. They have come back, actually, as well. But what happened was, I also ended up, when I moved away, was the most interesting thing. I moved away when I was in middle of high school in 15. And, you know, as much guff as I take from the Virginia Tech point of view, I also take some from other things, like not just as a Cleveland fan as well. And that's the interesting thing.
Because you're a closet Wizards fan?
I was defending to the teeth.
Oh, what? Come on now.
What?
What, because you're a closet Wizards fan?
Oh, is that fair?
Silly things like that. I cannot stand the Wizards.
You have a Gilbert Arenas jersey on right
now. Blowhard announcers in the league. You have to listen to this guy to understand. I mean, it hurts your head. But when Virginia Tech came along, and you guys mentioned some interesting things when you came up, because like so many, and I also have nothing against a team like the Ohio Bobcats or anything. It was actually the first school that accepted me. I almost went there, actually. My family has gone there, my brother and my dad. But there is a difference. And it was also mentioned how it would be a great type of win for the program. See, and therein lies a difference. It's not so much that mine's a different school other than the one that, you know, I grew up watching. I watched teams like in 95 and 96 and 94, you know, teams that were really, really good but ended up, you know, losing to those guys and Cooper and all those things. And I saw that, and I went to a different school that has a different stake in it. It isn't a BCS conference, and a loss in that game means I have as much to lose as a Virginia Tech guy as any Ohio State fan, where Ohio, if that would be the upset of the entire year in college football, without question. It's different programs as well. And, you know, it's also a newer program as well, so it doesn't have the historical background that just generational. I mean, it is, there are new Ohio State fans, and all of us have gone back so far. But their Tech has not been around. It was independent for 30-some years until the newly formed Big East let them in, and they got to have yearly games against teams like Miami, who, when they're good, they're really good, and they're a bunch of jerks, too, but that's another story. And other teams like that, Boston College in both of them. There's Florida State now, even though that they're not on so good times. Tech can't seem to beat them. But to me, a lot of it is why I support the school that I went to, because I have a lot of fond memories from the years that I spent down there, just as all you have of your various alma maters as well, and seeing some of those teams. And 99 is what really did it, because we all know what fans of not just Ohio State, but all of Cleveland means, right? And in that, in the 99 season, the first year of Michael Vick, of course, this is pre-call me by my first name, Mike, and pre-Ron Mexico, of course. Michael Vick, and that team and that season unfolded. And
I want to know when pre-Ron Mexico was, because I think that that would be by definition before.
You know what it was? He actually kept his mouth shut and played football for 2 years in college. Michael Vick, even unlike his brother,
wasn't converting water bottles
into
bonds.
What happened to him in college?
I was just curious because I didn't know if he got the herp from like one of the young ladies there at Virginia Tech, or if perhaps it predated his time at Virginia Tech.
Jason, you knew he was going there.
Yeah, I know.
Well, things are entirely possible behind doors that we do not see.
Oh, I mean, I'm still surprised enough that they have girls at Virginia Tech.
Oh,
I mean,
come on,
people.
Look, this all strikes me as front-runner type.
Dude, these are
just
silly, immature blows, too. I mean, this has no real substance.
I'm sorry,
have
we met? That's what I do. I came to this station because that's pretty much my whole shtick.
Well, look, Rick, I
think it's one and useful one. It has been.
Yeah.
Rick, I've got a different kind of perspective, and I don't think that my allegiance is as strong, and maybe that's the problem here to this whole conversation from my end. And I kind of, in a roundabout way, pulled this out of Sam as well one day. My school, my college school to root for would clearly be the University of Maryland. Now, I absolutely hate Duke and North Carolina and anybody else in the ACC in basketball. And when it comes to Maryland, I don't care who it is, I'm rooting for Maryland. But I don't think Ohio State football fans would have a problem if I said that. Now, you tell me that Ohio State is playing Maryland in football, and I kind of almost like defer to Ohio State. Go, it's football. Ohio State would have far more to lose than I would the pride of Maryland Terp football losing, because they're not a football school. As I'm sure Kush would agree,
you're all insane.
Virginia Tech is not a basketball school, so that one probably wouldn't hurt you as deeply. And now, I remember I said something this season. I was mentioning how, why is it Ohio State or any college program in high top flight D1 are scheduling bums? And I'm not saying that about Ohio U, but I did say that in the context that, oh, by the way, Sam, you know Ohio State's playing Youngstown State?
Ooh, you know what? Good point.
Are you serious? Why would they waste their time?
You mentioned that to me tonight. I didn't know Youngstown State was Sam's school. So actually, you're in exactly, and I think they're playing them what, next year. So you're in exactly the same boat as us.
And
who
are
you rooting for?
I'm gonna have to vote for Youngstown State because
it's your school.
It's my school.
What a concept!
Yeah.
Holy cow! Ding 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 ding.
I was in the marching.
It's not
band.
That hard.
I was in the marching band. I remember how good it felt when my team won.
Completely discarded because he didn't grow up in Ohio and by his nature doesn't get it.
Get what? That you're all a bunch of front runners?
It's like growing up in Ohio and rooting for Ohio State.
For Ohio State is because they win.
Look here, Chad. Did you grow up a Red Sox fan?
Yes.
Okay, so when you move to, if you move to Cleveland, should you automatically be made to be an Indians fan?
No, but that's also pro sports, a totally different topic.
I disagree. I say if you grow
really?
Up as one fan,
years
you shouldn't
in Fenway Park.
To discard your loyalty to that team because of where you are and what you're doing to advance your life.
I'm not. No one's talking about that, but it is, I have no problem in rooting for the Indians, except, you know, if they play the Red Sox, then I root for the Red Sox.
Oh my God!
But I haven't questioned.
What?
I haven't questioned your ability.
That is.
I haven't questioned your right to root for the Buckeyes. What we're talking about here is when
you
your alma mater is out there playing versus another team. Who should you support? The answer is your alma mater.
Well, I can understand what people say.
You grew up rooting for, and you have the strongest connection to in your life. If you don't have a connection to a team in your life, that's fine. But it's not just about where you went to school. It's sports fandom is never that simple. It's about emotion. It's about passion. It's not just about a piece of paper.
You know who thought just like him?
Who?
I can tell you who understands his perspective exactly. And that was everyone that was involved in the Vichy government in 1940 to 1945. You would have fit in real well there, Paul.
Yeah,
look, the Germans have just crossed into Paris.
Yes.
Let's form a government and support them. Why? Because they're winning. Ooh, we're going to go ahead and support them.
I think
Paul, the front-runner Frenchman. I will support the front-running Germans.
Well, he is half
a collaborationist.
That's what you are. You're a front-runner. You're a front-runner. You root for them because they win.
Hold on.
In fairness, you know what? The Browns stink, and I root for the Browns. But based on your whole philosophy, I should be rooting for the Bengals right now because my team's not.
No, he's saying exactly the opposite. Right. In fairness, his pops is from Ontario, not Quebec. Just to set the record.
Hold on a second.
He's not French Canadian.
Yes.
Let's forget. I know it's the crux of the discussion. Forget college for a second, because I hate to say this, but I will honestly. I can be swayed no matter what side of the fence I'm on, and really. If I may, and T will correct me if I'm wrong, that basically what's going on here is from the beginning, no matter who you are or when your father or mother or whoever that influenced you in sports said, taking the Browns, for instance, I knew Jim Brown was the best football player ever before I ever knew one thing about football. So you have basically 20 years, 18 to 20 years of knowing that this is my team, and no matter what, hellfire and brimstone, I'm a Browns fan.
Right.
That doesn't and make that the Ohio State argument that no matter what, since the beginning of my time, I've been an Ohio State fan, that I'm supposed to throw all of that to the side because I went to school for 4 years in one place.
No one's talking about throwing it all aside.
It's
We're talking about one game.
What are you going to do on one?
So why
the question is one Ohio day. Your goal at the end of the season is to walk away with a crystal football. That is the goal of Ohio State University football fans. Yes, it is. Now, one game if Ohio State loses it, they fall out of the top 25. They are dealt a grievous blow to their BCS chances, much less their national championship hopes, and basically their season, barring an Ohio University foray into the top 25, is basically a pile of crap for the rest of the way out. Meanwhile, a close loss for Ohio University still retains a modicum of respectability and, in fact, garners credibility with potential recruits because they're able to go into one of the most hostile environments in college football and come away with their heads held high, having left everything on the field as their coach teaches them to do.
Well,
there is nothing wrong with hoping that Ohio State wins the game because you want, as you are an Ohio State fan, born and raised, you want a national champion. If you lose to Ohio University, you do not get a national championship.
I have the exact. Well, as Boise State show, we could at least maybe go to a BCS game. Wouldn't that be fun? I had the exact same situation. My father went to the University of North Carolina. I grew up, I was raised a Tar Heel fan. I went to basketball games. I went to football games. I bled Tar Heel blue for the first 18 years of my life. And I still will cheer for the Tar Heels. They're on TV, football, basketball. But when I went to Ohio University, that became my team. When Ohio went to Chapel Hill a few years and played them in basketball, I rooted for the Bobcats.
And beat them.
Woo! When we played them in football and I went down there to Chapel Hill and sat in those seats that I sat in many times rooting for the Tar Heels, I rooted for the Bobcats. It doesn't mean that I suddenly just went, I threw everything out about the Tar Heels. I still love the Tar Heels. I actually spent a semester at North Carolina attending school, but I still root for the Bobcats when they're playing.
Yeah,
over North Carolina,
and
that's what we're talking about.
This way.
Your alma mater, where you chose to go to school, backing them for that one game over another opponent,
and
get Ohio State or they're playing against Kansas or they're playing whatever.
It's fun also to be the heel fan in the opposing stadium. It's only happened to me once in my life in Ohio Stadium. It'll happen again next year. There's something to be said for the change of pace of going in there and being the obnoxious guy.
Being a heel, period.
Yeah, I'm a heel for 2 hours on Thursday night, sitting next to you, Paul, as you well know. I want to say also, to paraphrase the Miller High Life Repo Man guy, you bite Bobcat Attack, Bobcat Attack's going to bite you. There's a proposed man law on there now to take the diploma from anybody who roots against Ohio University in any situation. So I'm sure that's going
to
do a lot to raise.
That prove to you right away what a bunch of freaking mouth breathers, just not even just at Bobcat Attack, but at any sports message board anywhere are that they take such parochial and narrow and just stupid views as to say, this guy should lose his diploma because he's a Buckeye fan first. That's the stupidest bleeping thing I've ever heard. When you have people active in the faculty who want to cut funding at Ohio University from sports to the point that they are threatening to cut four sports right now.
Right. Well, we're not going to settle this.
Those people are immersed in academia, and you have these freaking idiot asshole mouth breathers on Bobcat Attack saying stupid shit like that. That burns me up.
Oh, wow. Oh, you're burning up, are you? Oh.
Well, look, we're not.
Look, here's the bottom line. Here's the problem, Paul. His whole position comes from utter ignorance, and that is this. He does not understand the history of Ohio University being the first university in this state. He does not understand
the Western Reserve.
He does not understand He also does not understand the history between Ohio State and Ohio University, and the detrimental history that Ohio State, the various things that Ohio State has attempted to do through the years to defund Ohio University completely. A, B, there was a period when they also attempted to make them a branch campus. They wanted to make Miami a branch campus. They attempted to defund Miami and Ohio.
Yeah.
The point is that if he understood the history in terms of Ohio State trying to drum under the school that he supposedly got his degree from, then he might understand this a little bit better.
How do we end up in a situation here, John, where more and more teams are moving to the 3-4 in a league where almost no colleges are churning out 3-4 ready players? Guys like Cameron Wembley are having to be projected as a 3-4 outside linebacker, Vernon Golston, et cetera. We've seen that. Some guys have been able to make the transition, some haven't. Colleges aren't setting guys up for this. It's almost like colleges aren't providing the right kind of education, you know, in other fields of life. You could almost kind of make that comparison here. But for the NFL purposes, what's your take on this, on a league where unless you're rating somebody from the Patriots or the Steelers or a successful team in free agency, you're not getting a guy you know can play the 3-4?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And I think what you're seeing is a lot of hybrid tweener types in colleges today, because I think college football coaches, as scholarships continue to get reduced, I think you're seeing college football coaches going after athletes more than physical attributes, meaning, you know, a certain height, weight, you know, that sort of thing. They're going after athletes, and they're thinking, you know what, if you give me an athlete, I'll plug them in somewhere on my football team, offense or defense, and make some things happen. And I think what you're seeing in the NFL is a little bit of the same thing. You know, they'll take Vernon Golston's a great example, a freak athlete, but the guy just doesn't understand NFL defenses, especially a defense like Rex Ryan. So he struggled to kind of, you know, is he a defensive end? Is he an outside linebacker? Well, those are two totally different positions in the National Football League, where at Ohio State it was Vernon, attack the quarterback, and that's what he went and did. So I think you're seeing, you know, teams like, you know, you mentioned the Steelers, the Patriots, even the Broncos now with Josh McDaniels coming from that New England system, they're going after intelligent football players, some guys that may not be athletically the most gifted in the draft per se or grade the highest, but these guys are, you know, guys that are getting 43 on the Wonderlic test, like Eric Decker, the wide receiver from Minnesota, did that the Broncos drafted. They're going after intelligent football players because they feel, you know what, all these guys are athletes. I'll take guys that I know can learn this system and learn how to play different positions, multiple positions, and I'll be successful. So I think that's what the successful teams in the NFL are doing. They're kind of ignoring just the physical attribute, the physical specimen, and going after more the intelligent player. Because like you said, college football is not teaching these guys the NFL game. They're teaching them more of a gimmick style because that's what wins in college football.
Well, that's interesting. And when you're looking at, you know, projectable type players in terms of attributes and in some cases mental attributes, that's an interesting way of projecting as opposed to the literal thing of a 4-3 guy coming into a 4-3 system. Now, that's a very interesting approach that McDaniels and some other people are taking. Jason, I'll segue to you next for this. Well, what are your thoughts on, you know, you and I have had some conversations off air about this 3-4 and a 4-3 and the fact that, you know, almost nobody's coming into the league ready for this thing, you know, especially in a league where if you're going to be like a 3-4 defensive end or even a 3-4 tackle and just be kind of like a space eater, that's a situation where You know, it's really hard to find guys in college who literally fit that bill based on their body of work.
Yeah, it's you know, for me, it's frustrating because I see the guys that have the size, speed, intangibles to play those positions. But like you mentioned out of the gate, most of these universities are not playing that style of ball. Now, the interesting thing is, as we saw last week in the NFL draft, there were just as many ready-to-go 4-3 nose tackle or 3-4 nose tackles as there were 4-3 defensive tackles, say, in the first 40 picks. So maybe we're starting to get a little bit more like the NBA, where teams are going to start drafting on potential more so than body of work. But it's the other positions that are more intriguing. As John mentioned, the hybrids, and I can only assume we're referring to the defensive ends turned outside linebackers. The fact that it seems like a 3-4 inside linebacker is, in fact, different than a 4-3 middle linebacker. Ultimately, I'd like to see more of these colleges and universities just go that way, because not that it's their responsibility to groom guys for the NFL, but if it works in the NFL, why does it not work in college, would be my next question.
Yeah, and it would seem to me that it might almost be the flip side of what you see, where guys like Charlie Weiss, when he was at Notre Dame, could tell kids, hey, I'll get you ready for the pros. You'll be in a pro-style offense. You know, if you were one of the few major institutions running a 3-4, that might be a selling point, too. Hey, you know, this is going to be a good spotlight for pro teams for you. Nate, how do you see this? I know you're somebody who me and you have just had countless times off air talking about X's and O's and the schematics of football and everything like that. How do you see an issue like this, and you know, the contradiction of a league that is obsessed with guys contributing right now, whether it be for salary cap purposes or otherwise, or maybe it's just the general win-now pressure, dealing with a situation where if you're running a 3-4, you're having to project like a mother on these guys.
Yeah, but I think it's already been, the nail's been hit on the head, Rick, that you draft the guys that are the smart players that have the physical skill set. If these are smart guys, to me, it doesn't really matter what system they came up through. They are adaptable. You know, I mean, if they're as intelligent as you and I are and they've got the football skill set, I think they can fit in. You know, the coaching in the NFL is, you know, the best coaching in pro sports probably with everything they do. And, you know, if a guy's young and eager and willing to do it the way he's told, I don't see it as big of an issue. I don't think that, you know, the 44 games they played in college, 48 games, and, you know, 40 games in high school, those 80 games, you know, it's not an impossible transition for those players to change into the new system and just to do it the way they're told, as long as they have that intelligence level and that natural skill set to complement it.
Okay, all right. So it's not anything that they're, you know, given it's like a tattoo on the forehead that they'll never get rid of. Okay, they can transition out of that. That's an interesting point there. I'll start the next cycle here with another question set up with you, John. This is something where I think Jason and I have talked about this off air a couple of different times here too, that this bygone notion in the NFL, we almost never see this anymore outside of what Tampa Bay did earlier in the decade with Mike Alstott here, of having a fullback who can actually contribute as more than a blocker. You got a lot of guys that are, you know, borderline guys. Certainly somebody I think like Jerome Bettis, it was big enough to play fullback, but the teams he was with never chose to use him in that way, particularly when he was with the Steelers there. It would have been interesting to see Parker and Bettis a lot of times on the field at the same point in time. Why do you think it is, John, the teams have shied away from this, and you basically only have one guy out there? The interesting thing is your Broncos might be the exception to the rule in this. Like when you had a Peyton Hillis or a Mike Anderson, sometimes they would line up at fullback. So maybe I'm asking the wrong guy, but I think you would agree, by and large, that doesn't really happen anymore. Why are these guys that are borderline size worthy of playing fullback not put there to be able to give greater flexibility for teams with their offensive packages?
You know, I think it's twofold. One, I think the number of players coming up that are willing to do what, like first, like a Moose Johnson did in Dallas, I think the number of guys that are just willing to do that, to just sacrifice themselves essentially, is dwindling, almost like the natural center in the NBA. You know, guys coming from Europe, seven-footers like Dirk Nowitzki decide, you know what, there's money in shooting three-pointers and staying outside. Forget this banging down low stuff. So I think part of it is that. And secondly, the NFL of today is, A, quarterback league, and two, it's a matchup league. So instead of putting two guys in the backfield where defense can very easily account for those guys, you know, let's spread these guys out. Let's get them out of their base package. Let's get them in a nickel. Let's get them in a dime. And let's throw the ball all over the field. We've seen it with the Patriots and some other teams, you know, the Colts, for instance, going three wide with a tight end like Dallas Clark that's not a blocker. He's a fourth wide receiver out there. So the National Football League is trending away from, you know, the 3 yards and a cloud of dust mentality and the power football mentality. I mean, the good teams can still do it, but, you know, the New Orleans Saints won the Super Bowl with Reggie Bush and Pierre Thomas not doing a whole lot of ground and pound. It was more, you know, flash and dash. And I think that's what the trend in the NFL is, and that's why the, you know, the natural fullback, you know, it might be a thing of the past for now. Now, everything in the NFL is cyclical, so I'm sure a team will bust it back out and bring it back around. But like you mentioned the Broncos, you know, Mike Anderson, converted halfback. Reuben Drones, when he went to fullback, was a converted halfback. Peyton Hillis, you know, was really a fullback at Arkansas because of the two guys behind him. So when the Broncos played him, he was more of a halfback and more of a ball carrier when he went to Arkansas. You know, so it's a combination of just the trend in the NFL and then the number of guys that can actually, you know, understand blocking schemes and want to play that position. You know, a guy like Spencer Larson that's playing fullback, quote-unquote, for the Broncos now is actually a linebacker. So those guys that are that size can go on the other side of the football, much more glamour position, and, you know, make more money.
Well, that's a very good point here, too. When you start to get into specialization, you know, and that's something that just has been afflicting all sports, you know, in recent decades here, you know, narrow roles that people get pigeonholed kind of into. I could see that playing a role in this. Jason, what are your thoughts on this as far as fullbacks and, you know, why we're not seeing more teams try to embrace the notion of the old school fullback? I know we'll never see a Jim Brown lead the league in rushing again from the fullback position, and that's fine. I understand that the game has evolved towards the scat backs, if you will, and that was even before the Brian Westbrooks and the Chris Johnsons came along. Ultimately, mobility has become the most important thing there, but why teams are willingly sacrificing the notion of having two guys in the backfield who are legitimate threats to carry the ball, what are your thoughts on that, Jason, on why that is?
Well, you know, as many times as we've had this conversation, and everything John said is really the reason this conversation evolves back around. And my concern is not so much utilizing a traditional fullback or a block-first guy who has the ability to carry the ball, but you always hear analysts refer to this man's NFL is a league of two running backs. You have to have two good backs in your system. It just seems more often than not you have the featured back and the change of pace back or the red zone guy or whatever. And my inquiry is more based in the New Orleans model or the Carolina model, which would dictate, in fact, that if you're going to have two backs, why can't they both be legitimate, and New Orleans maybe not so much, but legitimate featured backs in their own right or at least in their college career, and bring them over, and then bring the question back around to the original question, why can't we have them both on the field at the same time? Why can't I see D'Angelo Williams and Jonathan Stewart at the same time, thus creating some sort of a matchup issue in that as long as the formations are set accordingly, that theoretically the defense wouldn't know who's going to get the ball. And in that analogy, both backs being able to catch the ball and run in space would absolutely be a huge benefit. So as the NFL has evolved, I just get the impression that even though we're evolving towards something different, teams are still reluctant to try something truly creative.
Yeah, I think that definitely is the case from the way that it's going here. Nate, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, something like what Jason just described, that to me is infinitely less radical than the Wildcat, and yet Tony Sperano conceptualized it, put it out there. Half the league's ripped it off in one form or another, more than half the league, I think. If the league will embrace something as radical as that, Nate, why not what Jason was just talking about?
Well, because, Rick, and it's great because John pretty much hit about 80% of what's really going on, but what's the root cause of all this, Rick? It's so many times in big sports, it's money. What's marketable? What sells tickets? Fullbacks don't sell tickets, Rick. Nobody comes to a football game to watch the fullback. Nobody turns on a Sunday to watch the fullback. It's a quarterback league. It's a flash league. It's a touchdown league. That style of game doesn't put up the points they need to have to keep the momentum going for the money, for the fan base, and that's what's changed the style of football in the NFL. It's the glamour aspect, and there's nobody that cares to see a fullback. And you factor in, you know, your stars are the quarterbacks, and like John said, nobody wants to be fullback. Nobody wants to go out there and block for 40 plays a game and get one or two handoffs. The guys that are talented aren't going to take that role. And again, the machine of money is pushing for that role to be non-existent into the future. I don't know if we ever will see this come full cycle. I think the fullback may be a thing of the long past. I'm not sure we're ever going to see it again in the NFL.
Okay. That's an interesting point, and I would have I should have expected that there might be some, I'm not going to say conspiracy-oriented, but you know, quasi-conspiracy-oriented angle from you there about selling tickets and merchandising and whatnot. I'm not saying I disagree with you necessarily. I'm just saying I knew I could count on you to think of something along those lines.
It's all about the loot, Rick, like yeah. Kevin Garnett said. It's all about the loot.
I know you so well, buddy. I should have known you were going to go to that thing. And like I said, I'm not saying I disagree with you. I'm just amused that I should have been able to predict your answer a little better. All right, next.
Well, John took all the good answers, so I had to come up with something.
Hey, you got a compelling one, Nate, and that's what it's all about, is being compelling here.